Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 351.
This week on the podcast, House Democrats Heroes Act finally honors the heroes among us, lobbyists and rich people.
Plus, the Nordstrom Thornburg Task Force to study the validity of the Biden-Sanders task forces is now in session.
Plus, Democrats will not let coronavirus trample their record of losing winnable elections.
And everyone looking for a good reason not to vote for Biden got one directly from Joe Biden.
And we're struggling about how to make a super-duper missile joke when the president basically already made it for us.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Yes.
And you can find us ranting to each other via text, email, calls, Zooms, any of the devices.
All week.
Any of the technologies.
I said...
You can find that any day.
I told Lila earlier, I was like, this was the week that I was finally radicalized. And guys, I thought I was there already. So it's been alarming to me.
I know. You were there already too, and I was still really excited to hear that you've come.
I know.
I was excited that I was excited to find out that, as I apparently didn't know you weren't fully radicalized, that you had finally become fully radicalized.
Right.
So we're there. We made it.
I know. My background is a little bit different this week because earlier this week I had to have it set up to read a Bible verse for church.
Right.
And so there's like crosses on my wall like that just off to over here. And I was like, I have to redo that because I'm about to act very unChrist-like on this podcast.
And I thought it might be nice to remind people that even Christians are pissed off in this time. And that's okay.
It is, yes.
You know?
You should be, and they should be.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's only so much forgiveness we have room for.
Right. We're going to start this week with the Heroes Act, which stands for some nonsense. I don't even know. I didn't put it in the notes. I don't care.
Well, it's probably something like helping earn, you know, something that doesn't even make sense. So, like,
exactly.
I wouldn't.
Yeah. And before we get into eviscerating this, it's important to note at least one thing in that I realize that it's not all bad.
Yeah.
There's a whole third of it. It's like over $3 trillion, and $1 trillion of those dollars is for state and local governments, which we've needed. It needed to have been in the first bill. Democrats and Republican governors alike are looking for this money. It's needed. I get it. There's hazard pay for essential workers.
Sure.
There's stuff
critically important stuff.
Critically important stuff. But I think before we go through all of the things that makes this terrible, is that I live in the real world. And I have been, sure. You know, you like to talk about how sometimes I'm an optimist, and have been before. And I also understand that, like, sometimes when you're trying to pass these things, like, you have to give up some of your pet things.
Right.
Like, you have to sort of, like, make deals, and you have to sort of accept, all right, well, I don't love everything in there, but it does have $1 trillion for state and local governments.
Well, it's why we believe in going in with your big ask, because that's where you want to be compromising from. You don't want to compromise from the point where you already gave in.
And that's where this loses me, because the problem is that we already have Donald Trump saying that we don't need any additional funds right now. We have Mitch McConnell in the Senate saying that he has no interest in taking this or any other additional funds. Oh, this
and
also has another...
This a this laundry also, list of progressive concerns, by the
way. Right, exactly. This has another $1,200 in there, which the Senate has no interest in giving another payment, a direct payment out. So, like, we know that this is DOA in the Senate and with the president. So, ultimately, what this amounts to is it's a messaging bill. It's ultimately a platform, really, is what it is. I mean, because it's not going anywhere. So, knowing that, it does make it, I think, okay to say all the reasons that it's terrible, because you've basically got House leadership saying, this is the best that we think that we can do. And if this is the best that they can do, then
I don't know
what to say.
Right. Wrap it up, if that's what it is.
This can't be the best, like, that anybody can do.
No.
It just can't be.
This is a compromise bill. This is a bill that's the best that we can all do together.
Right.
This is a bill where we don't need Republican input because we've provided it ourselves.
We've provided it. I mean, It's got, let's go through it. There's a million things that it both has that are terrible and doesn't have that would have made it less terrible. Yeah. It eliminates the cap on how much you can write off on your SALTs, your state and local taxes. So right now there's a cap at you being able to write off only up to $10,000 of your state and local taxes. This eliminates that. So the only people, that's a tax break for the wealthy is what that is. That allows people, rich homeowners in Nancy Pelosi's district, basically.
In high cost, high tax states.
To write off more than $10,000 of their state and local taxes. On their federal taxes. That's in there. Why? No one knows.
Why would that be relevant to anything that's going on right now in... you either give mortgage relief or you don't.
Right. Yes, exactly.
You don't just give mortgage relief to very wealthy people.
Correct. There is now 501c6s are available for to receive federal funding in stimulus money. Those are like trade organizations that are basically like the institutional vehicle for corporate lobbying. So ultimately they're bailing out lobbyist groups initially. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure this came out. There was also, it was in the initial draft. There was a bailout for 501c4s, which are basically dark money groups.
Well, and also it's funny to leave the C6s in and not the C4s, because C4s also, like, you know, Planned Parenthood has a C4, which is their political arm so that they can advocate policy change and not violate their C3 status. So a lot of like nonprofits that you really love also have C4s, but also a lot of dark money groups are organized as C4s. But like, it's weird to leave in C6s and be like, we would never let C4s get this money, but C6s are incredibly important to the American economy. They're not.
Right. They're not. And I think the thing that is the absolute worst thing in here, because this is just signal calling to health insurance companies here.
Yeah. Is that, this to me is the thing that I'm the most angry about.
This is the thing that we should all be the most angry about for a couple different reasons. The left should be angry about it. Basically what we're talking about, the healthcare component of this bill is that they're just going to pay everyone's COBRA for them instead of offering any sort of healthcare. So this is egregious for a million different reasons.
Couldn't be more reasons.
One is, it's the main reason is that it's just a giant giveaway to insurance companies. Like, COBRA is just continuing to pay your employer healthcare, but you're unemployed. So they're basically just giving giant checks to whoever your healthcare company is.
Well, and that means that you're paying for the inflated private insurance cost of that care.
Correct.
So they are not just paying for your healthcare. You know, they're not paying for your healthcare in the most efficient way possible.
Right, that's the thing.
Funneling money into private health insurance companies that are using that money for the same bullshit, you know, 30% off the top, you know, institutional costs that, you know, they're not, I'm sorry, I'm too angry about it to even make a concise point.
It's not really, I'm not shocked that they don't have like a full scale Medicare for All plan in here.
Right.
Like, I just because why would they? They're who they are. But what doesn't make any sense to me is that for why they wouldn't just do it only now for a certain amount of time for the people who have, for only people who have lost their jobs.
Through the
Medicaid system. And the reason that it makes more sense to do that is because it's actually way cheaper to do that than to just allow these people to go onto Medicare and then pay at the Medicare rate would be way cheaper than paying people's COBRAs.
And it's cheaper for them and the government. It's cheaper on both ends, because how are all these unemployed people supposed to pay their high deductible plans that you're paying their COBRA for without jobs?
Exactly.
They can't.
And it also, you know, it ignores the fact that a lot of people who have lost their jobs probably did not have health insurance through their work.
It doesn't,
you know,
do anything for anyone who didn't have benefits through their past job.
We know 40% of people who make $40,000 or less have lost their jobs. A lot of those people were probably not offered health insurance through their employer. So now they've lost their jobs. And what? They're supposed to buy their own insanely expensive plan. Or maybe they already had an insanely expensive plan because they didn't have it through their employer on the healthcare market. And they're supposed to pay for that with what money? Because they don't have a job?
Yeah. No, it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't actually make any sense. The only reason that it makes sense is if you're a person who was saying, who wants to put in to law basically just, like, this is code word for, don't worry, insurance companies, we gotcha.
Yeah.
Like, that's all this is.
That, I think, is, I think that if you ask Democrats why they're doing this, they will have an answer, and their answer will be, this is so that they don't spike your premiums next year. And that should not be an acceptable answer to us, because we could stop that by regulating them.
Right.
So we are empowered to stop all of the things we're trying to, you know, we're theoretically trying to avoid by putting money back into the pockets of health insurers.
Right.
Anything that they're going to threaten you with is something that you are actually empowered as a member of Congress to try to regulate.
Right.
So this is just a giveaway to corporations. Right. We don't actually need to be afraid of these people. We actually have a public health care system here.
Right. And it's also...
It doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't make sense. It's also only covering, presumably, your COBRA premiums. So you're still, you're still left with paying any out-of-pocket costs, any deductibles, any of those things you're still responsible for, and you're unemployed.
And we also know that already 80 million people were underinsured.
Underinsured, right.
And so this doesn't address any of those issues. Right. And again, we're in a health crisis right now.
Right.
You actually do want people to have access to a doctor right now.
Right.
It is not actually good for any of us if 43 million people lose their health insurance, and if only 10 million or 20 million of those 43 million are able to recoup any sort of insurance costs through this ridiculous kind of program, then that's still 20 million extra people who don't have any access to care.
Yep.
That doesn't help us solve coronavirus, you guys.
No, it does not.
It's also I think one thing that's been really frustrating to me about the Democrats' approach to health policy in the past is that they operate often under the presumption that most people have employer-sponsored health insurance.
Right.
And for some generations, that's true. But that's really not the case for our generation and younger generations. And so that's a real generational divide. If you want to know why young people were so in for Bernie Sanders and older people could not understand why we were so radical, it's because so many more of us don't have benefits.
Right.
I mean, so many more of us. So any plan that works within an employer system in a market where it's looking like our jobs aren't going to come back, in an economy that's falling flat on its face and is changing rapidly, in an environment where we're going to waste a bunch of public taxpayer money on something that is not going to line our pockets later, is just an insane use of resources.
Yep.
Ugh, God. In any case.
So some other things that aren't in here now.
Right.
Those are the things that are in there. Originally, they were going to have $10,000 worth of private student loan forgiveness and public student loan forgiveness actually too. But now they, and I think actually the progressives were trying to get that to be $20,000. So it's now $10,000. Well, it's actually, well, it is still now $10,000, but it was just going to be like elimination of that debt, the forgiveness of that debt. But now you have to be economically distressed to qualify. So there's a bunch of markers that you have to hit to be able to qualify to have that loan.
Well, and often these kinds of markers do not take into account the differences in cost of living in different places. So if you lose your job in Nancy Pelosi's district, you're like way more fucked than you are if you lose it in rural Idaho.
Especially if you've got $20,000 worth of student
debt. I mean, that's just not, that's not a comparable circumstance. So that kind of solution, a means-tested solution is not a good idea in a crisis like this.
Right. And these, the one that we just discussed about student loan forgiveness and the next few things that we're going to list for you were all things that the left wanted in the first stimulus, the CARES Act. And then have been pushing to get into this act that it just didn't happen. So there's no prohibition of corporate mergers or greater protection against private equity in here. That is bad. There's no recurring cash payments. So, you know, you've heard a lot of talk about, like, you know, $2,000 payments sort of until we talked about it, I think, last week that a bunch of senators have signed on for that. That's a Bernie Sanders plan. That's not in here. It's just another one-time $1,200 payment.
Yeah.
There's no guaranteed paychecks that would keep workers off of unemployment. That's one thing that, like, the left has been have been using as, like, a big idea to sort of, and we've talked about that before as well on here. It's what Bernie Sanders has been pushing. It's what a lot of other countries are doing, actually.
Yeah.
And it's the whole idea of sort of, like, not having to restart the economy after it has crashed. Like, if you can just keep everyone on payrolls.
Well, if you're actually on pause, then people still have bills to pay.
Right.
So and this was something that to keep them on pause so that they can start up when the pause is over. It's not a pause if every company disappears.
Right. And this was something that Pramila Jayapal had been working on, and she actually had gotten pretty widespread support for it. Pelosi told her that she needed details on it, because I think she sort of only issued it as sort of like a thing that we should be doing. So she actually worked on the policy and then presented it, and it still got left out, even though there was probably enough support to include it. It got left out just because they wanted to leave it out. There was no moratorium or rent on rent or mortgage payments. There's no public ownership of stake in companies that, like, we are bailing out with our tax money.
The fact that we didn't learn this lesson in our last economic crisis is the one that is most infuriating, I think. Because we should own some of those banks we bailed out.
Those
should be half public banks.
For sure.
I mean.
There's no major green infrastructure in this, which would obviously add jobs that we could be doing right now. Nothing was done to reverse that, like, $170 billion real estate investor tax break that was tucked into the first package. Like, a lot of people thought the least that they could do would pass a bill to, like, get rid of that, but they didn't even bother with that. So this thing, besides having a few good things in it, which are necessary, if you are going to put out a bill that is like, here's our best ideas, like, it... as we said earlier, this can't be your best ideas. And I think that what really angered me so much here and sort of really got me angry about these task forces, which we're going to talk about in a second, and just sort of like about the state
he's angry about the task forces.
And just about the state of where the party's at right now anyway, Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic power structure here made it very clear with this bill that not only did they not care about any of these ideas from the progressives, but they actively wanted to kick them in the teeth.
We're
not welcome. They wanted to, this bill is as much a notification to the progressives that they do not matter, that the moderate wing of the party is the boss. That's who matters. They don't matter. And, you know, we don't care about you. We don't care about your ideas.
And it's an interesting thing for the House to do, given that that's really not what everyone else on earth is doing right now. I mean, you're seeing in the Senate, you're seeing a lot of moderate senators sign on to Sanders' plans.
You've got
because
Cory
we need
Booker,
to try something.
You've got Cory Booker out in the world advocating for $2,000 a month, and he signed on to the Medicare for All, at least through the end of this crisis plan.
Kamala Harris has too.
I mean, these
they
people
know
are
what
not...
side of history they need to be on when they want when they go for their political future and try to be the president next time.
Right.
And the fact that the House is not advocating for that vision of the future, even though it is acknowledged by most people in the party that that is the future we're going to have to hang on to.
Yeah.
Because the future of the party's there.
Yeah.
The fact that the future stars of the party and the current, you know, the current young stars of the party are signing on to Sanders legislation right now in the Senate and the House came up with this bullshit is a sign that something has gone wrong.
And I think that House progressives need to wake up. Because they told us after the last package, which they were not super happy with. You know, we heard all of them who voted for it. Everybody voted for it except AOC. Yeah. They were all out there. And she thought more people were going to vote against it. She sort of like felt like she'd been left out to dry on that. All of them came out and was like, this is imperfect, but it has a lot of good things. And we need to get money to people as quickly as possible. But at least that one had been negotiated in a bipartisan way, so we knew it was going to pass the Senate. So on some level, I can almost acknowledge voting for that. But, like, we as progressive voters are tired of waiting for the next time.
Yeah.
And you actually have enough people that if you were actively working against some of these things, like, they could have killed this.
They have a really large caucus right now.
Yes. And a lot of them are fake. I looked into who was in the progressive,
Congressional
Progressive Caucus.
Yeah, Gil Cisneros is in the fucking...
Right. It's like, you know, a lot of them might be having private progressive thoughts, like, in their own head, but they're not going to go out and buck Nancy Pelosi on a $3 trillion bill. But there are some of them. And I guess if I took anything away, if you look, you know, we were talking before this podcast started that the silver linings are the only things that we have. At least there were 9 of 10 of them that did vote against this. You know, so the squad of four is, has doubled, I guess. So, like,
well, and also the squad has empowered some other members to be bold.
Right.
Pramila
exactly.
Jayapal was one of the most progressive members of the House before the squad came in, but she had no one backing her up.
Right.
With backup, she's making these votes now.
Right. But she, you know, and as much as I love her, and she was probably at least the, she was probably the most outspoken against this, but the most outspoken she got was, you know, writing some tweets about it. And they were strongly worded, but like all the only thing that the CPC did was write a letter to Nancy Pelosi and ask her if they could delay for a couple days. They didn't whip votes against it.
Whip fucking votes. They like, could have, and also not only could they have, but there were 14 no votes on this bill, and 5 of them came from moderates who are borderline blue dogs, who come from frontline districts, who were people like Abigail Spanberger.
Right.
And if that was also a concern of theirs, and their concern was different than the progressives, it was spending.
Much different. It was different for a terrible reason. We're going to get to that in a second.
Of course. But those are people actually who I think might be willing to work on making sure that the spending is effective in a way that the progressives might actually be interested in. I think some of those members that come from frontline districts, a lot of them are people who have had to moderate their own positions in order to be in those districts. But they're having to go home and explain to their voters why we have these big corporate giveaways, too.
Right.
I mean, if spending is your concern, then you need to spend well. And the progressives are talking about spending more effectively than the moderates are right now.
Right. I think that had they actually sat down with each other, Pramila Jayapal could have explained to moderates why paying COBRA deductibles was not the thing to do.
Or absolutely. In terms where they could have brought that back to their district, too.
Yep.
I mean, I think the fact that 5 of the 14 votes came from, like, basically blue dogs is, to me, a sign that there was a lot of interest in killing this bill, actually.
Yeah.
That this became a loyalty issue.
Everybody was too scared to do it.
Yeah.
And that is what I think the Progressive Caucus has to decide what it is they are actually there to do right now.
Yeah.
We are in the middle. I mean, just always. You know, moving
but
forward.
Especially in a crisis.
But especially in a crisis when I think there has been sort of broad support for a lot of the ideas that they already had. Maybe not within their own party in the House. But, I mean, you know, good God. Like we said, we've got moderate senators talking about, you know, recurring one-time payments in Medicare for All. We've got Joe Biden acting like some of these things like might not be a terrible idea. And he's a Republican.
Right.
So I don't understand why they haven't put their foot down, especially on a bill that's DOA anyway. Like, this was a bill that they could have been like, no, we're not doing this.
Also, what do they think that wave in 2018 was for? This is what people sent them there to do. They sent them there to do bold things.
Yeah.
It blows my mind how, and I've actually, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this because there are some of these moderate frontline members who oftentimes make what I think are kind of chicken shit votes, but periodically stick their necks out in really important ways. It was a team of moderates that made that impeachment thing actually happen.
Sure.
It was that a bunch of moderate freshmen wrote an op-ed together and said, we should actually investigate this.
Yep.
It is those same moderates who just voted against this bill. There are people in frontline districts who know that they were sent there because things were not working the status quo was not working in Congress right now. So they are actually empowered to decide that now is the time to act. Like, there is reason to believe that that is what their districts actually sent them there to do. And so not being able to deliver actually harms them as much as it harms us.
Right.
And so I just don't understand why is the Progressive Caucus, which has grown significantly in the last 2 years, not able to act at all?
Yep.
I know that Gil Cisneros is not trying to vote
Jan
for
Schakowsky
socialists.
Jan Schakowsky is not going to buck Nancy Pelosi like on the floor of the
exactly.
House.
Exactly. Like, but there are policies that if there were enough of them would be dead on arrival enough to Nancy Pelosi that she wouldn't be able to pursue them.
Right. I mean, that's what I think they need to start doing. And maybe they're trying. The fact that 9 of them voted against it, like I said, is, you know, twice as many as the squad. So maybe this is something that they're working on. But like the fact that they didn't even whip votes against it, I think Ilhan Omar is the whip of that caucus. Like what? I know that she was against this bill. She tweeted a million times about it. Like, I just, if they are there to constantly get punched in the nuts by Nancy Pelosi, then they're doing a bang up job. Like, keep doing what you're doing. You're crushing it.
Right.
It's happening on a near daily basis. So like, if that's enjoyable for you, then fine. But it's not enjoyable for me.
No.
And I don't actually think that it's probably enjoyable for you.
When I also don't think this even needs to be your fight alone, because there are people in the center who actually need to deliver right now for their districts too. That's the most frustrating thing about this to me, is they actually don't need just progressives to kill this kind of legislation.
Right.
They can use some of these frontline moderates to help soften the blow.
Yeah.
Because those moderates also were brought there to change something.
Right. Exactly. And one of the things that they were brought there to change, or so they think anyway, this was the terrible reason that we told you that they voted for it, was because they didn't want illegal immigrants to get any of this money. Because in the first bill, it was based on your Social Security number to get that $1,200 payment. So in this bill, the Democrats changed that to being able to use your individual tax identification number, which is what migrant workers have.
Yeah.
And they use it to, guess what? Pay their taxes, by the way.
Surprise.
So they are paying their taxes. So they definitely should be getting whatever money that we're giving to that, to people in terms of direct payments. But there was a late-breaking amendment, like on Friday afternoon. It was one of the last things that they voted on before they voted on the actual bill to get that changed back to your Social Security number. And there were 13 Democrats that voted for that.
Like,
and it was the same batch of them that ended up voting against the final bill. And the reason was because they weren't able to defeat this amendment to go back to the Social Security number.
Like, how exhausting.
Right?
It's
like, that's what you're caring about?
Like, at a moment like
that's
this...
That's what you went there to do?
you were sent there to make sure that migrant workers who are paying exploitive wages and are paying taxes don't get any relief money. You just want to make sure that no young children in migrant worker households can eat mid-pandemic, I guess. I don't know.
Guys!
It's bad out there, you guys.
But at least they can vote from home now.
That's right.
Because they also voted on that.
Well, I mean, thank God, actually, because one of the things that I think, you know, was in some ways a Republican delaying point in the Senate, but it's still going to be, was the idea that, like, well, if it's not safe to be here, then I guess there's no business that we need to accomplish. And, like, we do need them to be able to work. And the collective age of everyone in the entire Congress is, like, 165 years old.
Right.
And so we can acknowledge that maybe it's not the safest for them to gather.
Yeah.
So I'm actually not... This was a party line vote.
Party lines.
I'm actually like not understanding.
I'm not either.
How Republicans came out against this. They were just like mad that they either want to like murder everybody.
I think they just
don't want to
work.
Or they don't want to work, which is like, A, taxpayers, if you're worried about waste, as many Republicans are, paying the salary of someone who doesn't want to work is the ultimate in waste. I mean,
right. It sort of fits into their narrative of, you know, small government, though.
It truly does. But I mean, like, I can't even understand, like, have a weird cockamamie reason you're against it on, like, a regular day where life is normal.
Right.
Sure. I don't know your life. But
yeah.
In the middle of a pandemic when it's, like, not safe to gather and there are actual, like, critical needs that your own constituents are facing, like, why be against this? Why not just be for it?
Yeah, I know.
Maybe I'm naive. I don't know.
It does allow proxy voting, which is weird.
Yeah,
I think.
Someone else can die on your behalf.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
For proxy voting, we can send Republican politicians to cast our votes for us so that if they want to die together believing coronavirus is a hoax, it's just them.
Right.
We'll see.
Sure.
In any case,
yeah.
They finally announced the task forces.
Yeah.
And their announcement of the task forces, who, by the way, had great people on them, are finally what got Brent on board with my theory that the task forces are bullshit.
I think that it was actually sort of like, it was that happening at the exact same time as the battle over what was going to be in that Heroes Act, where I saw what the Progressive Caucus was getting up to and how they were being treated, and then also sort of the shying away from an actual fight that they could have had. I think those two things coupled together really got me amped about these task forces, because I'm like, look, if like all of these people are just sort of like signing up, you know, to have their asses kicked by a bunch of moderates publicly, then these task forces are a great way to continue that.
Yeah. Which is what I said task forces were in the first place.
It was. And I noted as I was taking notes on this document, I don't know if you saw it, but I was like, kudos to Lila Nordstrom for, I feel like
at the very bottom, yes.
Had I listened to to your words about these task forces, I probably would have not had the reaction to the task forces this week, and I also probably would have not gone into like a rage spiral on Friday as they were voting on the Heroes Act, because I would have known that it was all bullshit.
What we were doing. Right. Yeah, so what's frustrating about the task forces is that they're great.
Yeah, I mean...
They have great people on them.
They have great people.
You know, they have Pramila Jayapal doing, as one of the co-chairs of the Medicare for All Task Force, and it's actually...
Well, the healthcare task force.
I'm sorry, the healthcare task force. Sorry,
they definitely don't have a Medicare for All task force.
No, but the is it Sanjay Gupta is the other co-chair? I mean, the other co-chair is a former.
It's Abdul El Sayed.
I mean, no, it's not.
Oh no! Oh, Biden from the Biden camp.
Yeah, the Biden the other camp one.
I can't remember who it is.
He's our former attorney general. He's writing. He's going around touring a book about how to be happier or something
got
right
it.
Now.
Okay. sure.
AOC is one of the co-chairs of the climate change task force.
Yep.
We have
Sarah Nelson
on the economy task force.
Right. She was a huge Sanders supporter. She's the president of the Associated Flight Attendant. Yeah, she's a big union person.
Right. Abdul El Sayed is on the Medicare for All task force. Right. The healthcare task force. One of the pioneers of modern monetary theory, Stephanie Kelton, is on the economy task force.
Yep.
We have the executive director of the Sunrise Movement.
Yep.
Varshini Prakash or Prakash. I never said that name right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm never going to, maybe. I don't know. but so, you know, we have people from the Sunrise Movement. We have AOC. We have the Medicare for All team.
The Sunrise Movement gave Biden an F, by the way, in their
deserved F. Right. And even, you know, Biden's people are not the worst of the worst. Karen Bass is one of his people for the economy task force.
Right.
And
she's got one of the most liberal voting records
Karen
in the
Bass.
House.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's one of our local congresspeople.
And John Kerry, while no progressive, is like at least a person that like I trust, like has some familiarity with the issues of climate change and that he did sign the Paris Accord on the behalf of the United States. I think it's going to be great to see him and AOC working on the same task force.
It was the idea that they're co-chairs together that I think was the first sign to me that something was amiss, because what better way to drown out the voice of a young woman who is a thorn in your side than to have an elder statesman who is a former Secretary of State be her co-chair?
I hope she is ready for peak mansplaining.
I mean, it is going to be mansplain city over there. And luckily, I think that they routinely underestimate AOC, and I think she will rise to this occasion as she does. She's the only person that I trust to like rise to an insider occasion like this.
Right.
I think, you know, you notice there are some names that are not on this list. Rashida Tlaib has not been invited to join the task forces.
She hasn't.
Because
I donated to her this week.
Oh, good. Donate to her because she's in a
primary
race.
Challenge right now. Yeah. Against the primary challenger from last time that she beat by like 900 votes or something like that.
Yeah. So definitely donate to her if you still have an income. Notably, she is not on this list because she is somebody who doesn't even play ball with this kind of bullshit.
Right.
AOC, I think, is actually really smart about how she gets into the room and then also upends the room.
Sure.
So I'm hoping that the John Kerry dynamic will not be too destructive. But,
right. You know, there's been a few... Right. Yeah. There's been a few people who have sort of like, hey, guys, like, at least there's no Larry Summers or Erskine Bowles on the, you know, economy task force. And
doesn't
I want
to
say something. Right. I want
to
say something about that.
Yeah.
Because Larry Summers and Erskine Bowles don't need to be on a task force because they just fucking called Joe Biden privately on his cell phone.
That's right. They're on a one-person task force.
They're on a personal task force with Joe Biden. Yeah. They don't need to be on a task force with Pramila Jayapal. That's beneath them.
That's right.
Like, that doesn't need to happen.
They call the president directly on a private line.
That's right. Yes.
Or Joe Biden directly. They used to call the president directly.
Right,
and that
exactly.
is how we got into this mess.
Right.
Now they call Joe Biden. He's not the president,
right.
you guys.
We call the Joe Biden administration.
That's right. The Joe Biden administration.
Yeah. So there's also a lot of people who are sort of like, maybe he'll actually, you know, the worst thing that could happen here is that, like, he just doesn't take anything away from these task forces. And this is something that I think you mentioned a couple weeks ago. It's certainly something Crystal Ball did a whole segment on it this week about, like, that isn't actually the worst that could happen. The worst that could happen is actually something more nefarious than that.
Yeah.
In that what they've done is they've brought the outside voices in.
They've made them complicit.
Right. in a way that I think they hope will shut them up going into November. Like, yeah. Wouldn't it be nice if you didn't have AOC talking about how much of a hack that Joe Biden is on climate change because she's on the climate change task force?
Right.
Wouldn't it be great if you didn't have Pramila Jayapal pushing Medicare for all right now, even in the face of the coronavirus? Like, wouldn't it be great if she just had her mouth shut on this task force working with whatever terrible person from Joe Biden's campaign is on there? And I think that there is this... there's a concern from the left, and it's real, and there should be this concern, that, like, these people are being brought in to be silenced.
Yeah. Well, that's what, to me, was the distinction between a task force and a meaningful promise.
Right.
A task force isn't a promise of anything. It's not right. A policy promise. A right. Task force is a place that you can discuss with any terrible person, any bad idea that you or they might have, and everyone can just decide not to listen. Yep. There has been no promise that these task force, how this task force information will be used, will how be these compromises right. will be implemented. I mean, there is no information from the Biden camp that these task forces mean anything.
No.
Other than that this is a very shiny list of people that progressives can feel good about having in a room.
Yep.
But you need to see the results of them being invited into the room in order to feel like that was worth the time. And the best thing that can happen is, of course, that Joe Biden takes their advice and moves his campaign to the left and thinks critically about how he actually does want to get younger voters and Hispanic voters and all of the many other kinds of voters he hasn't done any outreach to
right.
on board through policy. But the Joe worst Biden that can is happen is that he does nothing.
Right. But Joe Biden has, you know, a 40-year history of, you know, deal making, but with Republicans, not with the left.
Yeah. Yeah.
He is a person who has told all of his, you know, big money people that nothing will fundamentally change.
Right.
Those
are the words that he used.
Those are the words that he used. Right. He has done the bidding of all kinds of corporate interest over the last 40 years, whether it's big pharma, big insurance, big oil, big finance, anything that starts with the word big, Joe Biden right. has, you know, been in
them.
Favor of. He is right. He's there to protect them, to do whatever he can for them. So, like, the idea that, like, a task force is going to somehow do anything other than embarrass the progressives on the task force, I think is a silly thought to have.
Well, and especially because, I mean, you know, we just saw this happen with the HEROES Act where,
right.
like I said, I think they underestimate AOC. I think she is someone who manages to speak out regardless.
Right. But it's like Pramila Jayapal, who I love, is the head of the CPC and
yeah.
chose to not even whip votes. So, like, are we going to
exactly.
really, and I'm not trying to be, like, mean to her, but, like, how much
no.
do we trust her being folded into the Biden campaign? I think it sort of changes the dynamics of what she sort of, like, feels like she can do in the House, speaking out against some of the things that, like, Biden himself stands
well,
for.
And she's also more a part of the House. I mean, I think AOC is almost protected by her youth. She gets to do stuff because she's young and she's openly inexperienced, but, like,
right.
in a way that makes her fearless. And that's, we have a few years of that before she gets folded into the mix, probably. I mean, I don't know. Hopefully she never does. But I just, there's no one else who is doing that right now.
Right.
Who is that kind of fearlessly speaking out. And I think part of it is that she's just protected by her lack of knowledge of what the blowback is going to be. It's,
right.
it's all sort of new to her. But Pramila Jayapal is not. And so she is someone who came in with a lot of big ideas and is not afraid to say what those big ideas are.
She was really most outspoken against the bill, at least in her own
yeah.
words. I don't really think that she
but
backed it up.
She
but,
is certainly somebody who's been in the House longer, who's been in government longer,
yeah.
who has more of a sort of, who has a tendency to not speak out in the same ways when it's going to be really controversial.
Yes.
You know?
Yep.
I think that's, it's sort of a list of people that I really respect, but I'm worried are not going to have the political leverage. Because the other thing AOC has is separate fundraising. AOC can
yes.
raise her own money.
Right. She doesn't need their money.
She doesn't need their money. And so
yeah.
that's why Bernie Sanders does this. I mean, can
right.
do this, you know,
yeah.
it's because he doesn't need their money. So, and it's why Liz Warren couldn't. because she did need their money. Because
she did, and she's taken it before.
And she's taken it before, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of this has to do with unfortunate realities that we can't really help that are not these people's faults. But, like, a task force isn't a policy promise. And if these people suddenly become complicit in the platform that Joe Biden puts forward when it is not going to be a progressive platform, then we lose our ability to criticize it. And part of our job as progressives is going to have to be to criticize it. Because we want him to move further to the left. And he needs to know that he hasn't met us yet if he hasn't met us yet.
Right.
I think I actually will, like, I have a good sense of, like, where someone could meet me that is not where I want to be, but, like, is somewhere that I would feel, like, was positive progress.
Right, that you had
been
thinking
about this a lot. Yeah. And I even think, like, the thing that I've been thinking about specifically on healthcare, because obviously that's the issue I think about the most, is I respect that Joe Biden is not a Medicare for all guy. He is not going to institute Medicare for all. And I get that. But what I want to hear him say is our goal is, of course, Medicare for all.
Oh, yeah. We've talked about this. Yes. I think you're absolutely right.
And here is my plan for getting there. And it's a long-term plan. So I'm not going to institute all of this stuff. But, like, this, I see this as a piece of the step towards Medicare for all.
Yep.
And if he could just say that without promising anything different, I would feel better. But, like, the fact that he can't even do that makes me think that Pramila Jayapal telling him that he should is not going to necessarily change anything.
Right. As, like, if he hasn't heard it before.
Right. As if no one has given him this information before. Like, you know.
Yeah.
So, in any case, how disappointing to be potentially right about the task forces being bullshit.
I know. It's upsetting, isn't it?
Yeah.
You didn't want to be right about it.
I wanted your optimism to win.
Nope. The last time you'll hear it.
I was excited. Well, I was actually saying to my mom, because, you know, I think everyone who's on the left is feeling very pessimistic right now. And I think we have to remember that being progressive is an inherently optimistic position to take. We believe that people are, you know, that people deserve our help and our care. We believe that everyone is worthy of that help and care.
Yep.
We believe that we are, as a society, empowered to change people's lives for the better. Those are optimistic positions to take, even if our feeling about how it's going is not so great at the moment. It is so much easier to think that the status quo is the best we can do.
Yeah.
But progressives are constantly thinking, couldn't we do better than this? So it's actually, like, an incredibly optimistic point of view to have. It's an incredibly optimistic movement to be a part of. It, even in the moments where it feels the most hopeless, there's nothing more optimistic than being a progressive. And thinking that we could do better, government could do better, we collectively are more powerful than we are individually. All of those are very optimistic positions. So even in our dark moments, we are actually the more optimistic of the...
Hey, thanks for that.
Yeah, you know?
I needed that.
Yeah, a little pep talk. Lila Nordstrom TM
pep
talk.
From you to me. That's right. Not how it goes, usually.
Well, listen, I've been talking a lot of progressives off the ledge. And sometimes it goes in circles because sometimes my mom has to talk me off of a ledge and then other times I have to talk her off of a ledge.
I feel like you've been pushing me over it all week.
I know.
You're just excited that I'm there with you now.
Yeah, I was already on that part. I was already off that ledge, so I was just... confused as to how you weren't seeing what I was seeing.
And now you're not lonely.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But that's the sort of larger optimism is the most, I think, sort of critical part of our political ideology.
No, I think you're
right. So, like, you can't forget that, even as you think that these people are not progressive. So, of course, we're not feeling optimistic about them.
No.
I don't think government can work better with non-progressives leading it.
No.
You know? But I believe that government could work better.
It's intentionally designed to not work better with progressive not leading it.
Exactly.
It's designed to stay the same.
I think a progressive leading it would show that government could work wonderfully, but that's not the position we're in. We're not.
Nobody wants that.
Joe Biden isn't on some scale of progressivism. He's not a progressive.
Right.
He's a moderate. He's a status quo moderate. He wants things to go back to the way they were because he wants nothing to fundamentally change.
Right.
And it is optimistic to think that things can and should change, and we are those people.
That's right. Yes.
In any case.
Oh, boy. Democrats.
In California.
Doing what they do best.
Speaking of optimism.
Crushing progressives and losing elections.
Moderates. I mean, conservatives, very optimistic in the last week about this election.
Oh, God. There were two special elections this week. One was in Wisconsin. People, I feel like, incorrectly were thinking that like that was going to be a potential thing, but it's like it's like, a weird time. It's there. A special election. It's been a Republican held seat since the beginning of time.
They tried to kill everyone a few weeks ago in their primary.
So like we're not going to talk about the one in Wisconsin because like I realize that there have been some seats since Trump took office where we have flipped like 20% margins, but like that wasn't going to happen there. There's just no chance of it. So we're not going to talk about that one. No. We're going to talk about the California 25, Katie Hill's old seat, because that one is obviously winnable because it was held by a Democrat. Right. So
a progressive Democrat.
So we know that it was winnable. We're going to talk about that one because Mike Garcia this week just slaughtered Christy Smith in CA25. Yeah. Badly. I mean, 10 points.
Yeah.
And Katie Hill had won by 9 points. We talked about this last week that signs were sort of like pointing that Mike Garcia was going to win, but like this was a bloodbath and it should be a cause for alarm. And I know that the DNC and a lot of people are sort of trying to make you think that it shouldn't be cause for alarm, but I don't know how it isn't. That doesn't make sense to me. Like, be alarmed if you lose an election in a 20-point swing, even if it's in the middle of a pandemic and it's a special election, so there's no other elections going on at the time. Like, you still have to pretend like you care about winning elections.
That's right.
Which is partly why they lost, because they didn't care about winning this.
Yeah.
You know, no, there's this...
DNC did not offer support in this race.
No. Some late support, anyway, when I think they probably thought that it was going to crap. But, like, this was... And, you know, we talked about this last week in that Katie Hill election. You know, she ended up winning by quite a big margin, but, like... That was due to, like, massive, massive, massive turnout. And that was due to a lot of on-the-ground work. It was due to a lot of celebrities being there. And it was also due to the fact that, like, Katie Hill was a badass candidate.
Yeah.
And she drew turnout because people wanted to vote for Katie Hill.
She was a dynamic candidate.
Right. Also,
and an exciting candidate.
A Medicare for All candidate, by the way.
A progressive candidate.
Christy Smith, not progressive, not a Medicare for All candidate. Boring person. Sorry, Christy.
She's lovely. I've met her a few times. Always been lovely.
I'm sure she's lovely.
She is not. She did not run the kind of dynamic race.
Would go to Washington and be a good legislator.
Absolutely. But she did not run the kind of dynamic campaign that Katie Hill did, in part because she couldn't, but also in part because she was not sort of willing to make the kind of bold choices that Katie Hill made.
Right. But the turnout was just terrible.
Abysmal.
It was like 34%, and everyone had a ballot. And there
was nailed everyone a ballot.
You could have voted twice in that election.
That's right.
I mean, you couldn't have. But, so, like, there was no reason other than just not really caring about voting for Christy Smith. I mean, truly. And also, not only have we seen that turnout is the name of the game, which we have, as Democrats, have known for a long time, which is a weird thing to understand when you're looking at Joe Biden as your presidential candidate. Like, that's where we net it out. If you're a party that knows that you have to drive turnout and then you've decided that that's where your horse you're going to ride in on remains flabbergasting to me. But regardless, that's a separate issue. I just don't. So we learned that. We learned that turnout was as important as we always thought it was. But we also learned that Republicans are continuing to vote for Republicans. The Republican turnout was very, very, very high. It was way higher than Democratic turnout.
It often is in special elections. They are much more reliable voters than we are.
And guess who all of the Republicans in this district that is supposed to be a moderate district, like in Ventura County, of just sort of like vague rich people outside of outside of Los Angeles... These are supposed to be the type of people who you would think would be like, oh, well, Donald Trump and the, you know, Republicans are a bridge too far. Like, we are voting for, we're going to vote for Christy Smith because I just am too offended by the idea of Donald Trump or whatever it is that they're
offended
by.
Return to civility.
Right. That didn't happen. It didn't happen in 2018. That's not why Katie Hill won.
Nope.
And it's not why, and it's not a reason... that Joe Biden should be going after these type of voters. Because, alert, they're not going to fucking vote for you.
No, they're
They never were. They vote for Republicans. They always have. They continue to do so. They will so in the future. And they're not going to vote for Christy Smith. They're not going to vote for Joe Biden. They're not going
to find in this race that it was a bunch of former Katie Hill voters that put Mike Garcia over the edge. What you're going to find is that Democrats stayed home. Or not even stayed home. Democrats stayed off the ballot. Mm-hmm. Because the thing that Democrats have in this district and many districts we routinely lose is a registration advantage. There are more Democrats.
We have more registered Democrats in this district.
Yeah.
Like 30,000 more.
Exactly. Plenty more. Enough more that you don't even need to tip your hat to a Republican ideology of any sort. All you have to do is convince both progressive and moderate Democrats to show up.
To go.
And then you cough a little and then you feel better. But so the idea that also our meaningful votes are to be found in the middle is not actually true. There's not a meaningful group of people that are like, I don't know, should I vote for Joe Biden or Donald Trump? I just can't make a decision. There is
a
meaningful group of people on the left who might stay home. There is a meaningful group of people in the middle who might stay home because they're just unenamored with this whole process because it's so horrible.
Right.
There is not this mystery group of like white, middle-aged, suburban men who are just like, that is not a meaningful voting demographic. And they are the only people the Democrats are going after.
Right. We're banking our entire election strategy on that. And it's not a thing.
It's not a thing. Those people are either Republicans or Democrats, and they vote as either Republicans or Democrats. And if you're wondering where all of these Obama-Trump voters came from, they came from farther left than that. They were sort of vaguely libertarian, but also kind of like Bernie Sanders-y type Democrats.
Right, they were people who had lost their jobs because of bad trade policies.
Exactly.
They were, certainly some of them were racist, like, let's be honest. Okay, they were people who, like, felt good about voting for a black guy and then wanted to go back to their comfort level, which was voting for racists.
But I mean,
like, I don't want to poo-poo that, but, like, that's...
This is not where we find our victory, is with these mystery Republican voters. And if you go after them, you give up everyone that's actually important to your victory.
Yep.
I mean, you can't have it both ways.
Right. You have to drive turnout to get these people out. And I just don't. Christy Smith can't do it herself. God bless her. Joe Biden can't do it himself. The only thing that could save us in this election, and look, it might work. You know, like our hatred of Donald Trump. Democrats' hatred of Donald Trump just might be enough. That was a huge factor in 2018. It certainly wasn't the only factor, and I think to say that it was the only factor ignores a lot of other important factors.
It all ignores most of the factors.
It also ignores most of the factor, but it was a factor. You know, Donald Trump wasn't on the ballot, but a lot of people were voting for Democrats because they were voting against Donald Trump. And I get that. But it just seems like a real dicey election strategy to bank your whole thing on taking back the House and the Senate and winning the presidency on just not liking one guy.
Yeah.
That is troubling to me.
You can, as I have said, I think in the past, as I've been struggling with what one does with their own vote when they're as angry as we are, a vote for someone is an affirmative choice, but a choice not to vote is not a choice I would make personally, but is a choice where you are not forced to validate something terrible, but are also able to not validate something terrible. So, like, if you are somebody who doesn't like Donald Trump, you can also not vote for him and not vote for Joe Biden. I'm not suggesting that that's what you should do, but that is a thing people can do if they are feeling unenamored with Donald Trump. That doesn't necessarily translate into a vote for Joe Biden, is what I'm saying.
Right.
You have to make them also think, you know who's a good guy who would definitely be a positive step in the right direction, is that Joe Biden guy. That is not the same as them saying, I really hate Donald Trump. And I think that oftentimes the Biden campaign has sort of talked as if those are one and the same. And Democrats like to talk as if those are one and the same because they like to say, well, you're voting for Donald Trump if you're not voting for Joe Biden. But that's not actually how a lot of people vote.
Right.
And I mean, obviously, we don't think that's the case either. That's a dumb talking point. But if you think that's the case, that's not how a lot of people vote. And we know that because so many Democrats just don't show up.
Right.
And it's not our job to make them show up. It is your job as the candidate to make them show up.
Right.
So if you have to know that there is a way for them to not vote for Donald Trump and still not win.
Right.
Like those aren't mutually exclusive things.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
In any case.
Ugh.
Speaking of voting or not voting for Joe Biden, he also asked us not to vote for him this week.
Right.
So if you were looking for what to do with that.
If you were looking for a reason not to, he's been listing them out for us specifically since 1979.
That's right. Yeah. So there's a very specific list of people who he believes should not vote for him.
Right. This week we found out one of those groups of people mm-hmm. are people who believe Tara Reid.
Yeah.
Don't
and
vote
if that's
for
all it takes.
He said in an MSNBC interview that anybody who believes that he did that in 1993 probably shouldn't vote for me.
Great.
The latest polling within the Democratic Party is that 20% of the party believes her, by the way.
I'm
so,
shocked that it's not more, because also his
But it's
his,
a large enough portion of the party that you maybe don't want to tell
yeah,
them not to
ask
vote
them
for
not
you.
To vote for you.
Right? Because a lot of people are going to make the calculation that, like, maybe I believe her, but also he's not as bad.
Right.
So, like, to say to them, don't vote for me, is a questionable choice at best.
That's right.
Yeah. But he's been doing this, as I mentioned, since 1979. Yeah. This is like a go-to line of his. Like, look all the candidates over, and if you like them better than me, then you vote for them. Which, like, look, as like a vague, like, speech kind of talking point is kind of like a, you know, folksy kind of thing to do.
Yeah,
like,
say
look,
it on the soapbox.
Just compare everybody and, like, you know, if you like that guy better, then you vote for him. And if you like me, you vote for me. And, you know, it sort of like fits into his whole sort of like no malarkey
style
of like. It would
be great for an Iowa soapbox event.
100%. Right.
Ideal.
The problem is that he has said this in regards to specific policies before. Right.
Policies that most of the left does not agree with him on.
Correct. So besides recently telling MSNBC about the Tara Reid thing, last year an immigration activist was pressing him at a South Carolina event about like the deportations during the Obama administration, which, by the way, he's been pressed on from all sides. He's been pressed by candidates about that, like
right.
Julian Castro. Various people have pressed him on this. And he said in response to that, you should vote for Trump.
Oh, great.
And then also... at the beginning of this year, actually, this was right before the Iowa caucus. I think it was in Iowa. Ed Fallon, who's an environmental activist, was approached Biden about his climate positions. And Biden responded, you have to vote for someone else. You're not going to vote for me in the primary. So he is, look, if you have been thinking to yourself, I don't know, I don't really want to vote for Joe Biden, but I wish I just had a good reason not to vote for Joe Biden.
He asked you not to.
There's three good ones.
He's asked you, and this, by the way, this one in January was said before primary, and he said, don't vote for me in the primary.
Don't vote for
me
in the primary. Correct.
If you start saying that shit in the general, then you are asking people not to vote for you.
Right.
I mean, that's.
And I think it's important because we're going to talk about two sort of related stories right now, and it actually relates to one of the reasons that he just told us that we didn't have to vote for him. The one about what he said to the immigration activist, because his campaign manager this week said that he now thinks that Arizona and Texas and Georgia, which is what's a part of the story, are now in play.
Which is funny, because it seems like he's running a Republican campaign for office then.
Right. And I would say that he's not wrong about that. You know, we saw what happened.
Arizona and Texas, we've been talking about for a long time.
We've been talking about for a long time. Arizona has now elected, Arizona has a Democratic senator. Texas almost had a Democratic senator. The turnout in Texas this year was very high for the primary. So I think he's right about that. The demographics of these states have been trending in that direction. And it would be huge if we could get like Texas, I think, is still probably like a bit of a pipe dream, especially with him at the top of the ticket. Arizona, I think, is more likely that that could actually flip. And
that's
that would
trending
be, and that would be huge because it would sort of allow you to, once you start flipping things, like then the map gets much easier for you. I mean, if you start winning Arizona, then it's like Wisconsin becomes less important. Hopefully you win both of them. But like, you know, you open up the map if some of these things sort of like become more in play. And he's going to make a play for them. And I think that's a good idea. But the problem with both Arizona and Texas is the reason that those have become in play is because it has a huge population of Latino voters.
Mm-hmm.
I think something like a huge chunk of the entire Latino community in the United States lives in just five states. And two of them are Arizona and Texas.
Yeah.
The biggest non-white voting bloc now. There's going to be 32 million eligible Latino voters, and 61% of those eligible voters are under 35. So he needs Latinos and young people to vote for him to win either of those states. And the problem with the Biden campaign since the beginning of the Biden campaign has been twofold: getting Latinos to vote for you and getting young people to vote for you.
Those are the two groups.
Those are the groups. Those are the two groups.
He got old white people to vote for him.
Right.
He got old black people to vote for him. He got some younger black people to vote for him. He has not successfully been getting Latino voters or young voters.
Right. So you might think to yourself, well, if he was having those problems during the primary, he has obviously, if he thinks that he's going to be winning Arizona and Texas, squared those things away.
Right.
He's gotten his Latino outreach program under control. Right? That's what you would think to yourself.
That's what you would think.
No. It's a huge article in Politico this week about how his Latino outreach is a massive clusterfuck of a disaster.
And it also feels like this is something he actually could have learned from 2016 as well. Because the Sanders campaign certainly did. They did much more focused and aggressive Latino outreach this time. They made sure that they made it kind of a part of the larger campaign and not just some sort of special outreach as if they were just doing outreach to a special interest group. They made their larger campaign something that Latino voters would feel included their needs.
They made hires. They included community activists and organizers. They did all of the things that, like, are sort of easy to do, you know? Yeah. I mean, like, kudos to them for actually doing it, because you're right, they took a note from 2016. But it's like,
the note was freely available to all parties.
To all people. Everyone
could have gotten this note. It wasn't a secret note.
Yeah, exactly. But they are not doing it right now at all. There's little evidence that they're doing anything. In fact,
I mean, there's little evidence that they're doing much to campaign beyond talking to rich people on Zoom.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell, because in general, his campaign hasn't accomplished much in terms of campaigning. But at no point in any of this process has he done really any meaningful outreach to the Latino community.
Right. He's also refused to release statistics of the diversity of his staff, details which almost all of the people who he was running against in the primary released, like, fairly early, actually. And he just made a majority of, like, a dozen recent high-level hires who were all white.
Mm-hmm.
And he has also not actually spoken to or even been formally endorsed by Julian Castro, by the way, which is interesting.
He's one of the
last holdouts from the primary.
Do we think it's because he hasn't been approached, or do we think he is just, like, way cooler than we ever gave him credit for? Because
supposedly they haven't spoken, so...
That is such a weird oversight.
Yeah.
Like, such a weirdly ridiculous oversight to have made as... I mean, they thought to call everyone else.
Right.
They got all the other people who got out of the race early, got on the Joe Biden train immediately. The idea that they have not bothered to reach out to Julian Castro...
Yeah.
Is, like, mind-blowing to me.
Right. But the digital organizing director for the Hillary 2016 campaign said, and I quote, "I do not think that the Biden campaign thinks that Latinos are part of their path to victory." Oh, what?
Hmm.
What?
They just think they're going to win Arizona because Republican white people are going to vote for them, I guess.
Oh,
I don't know.
Oh, right. Of course. Yes.
Yeah. Forget about the large voting bloc that you could win easily with.
Right. Bill Richardson said that there has, quote, been little or no activity in the Hispanic community from the Biden campaign. And then he said the Trump Hispanic effort is much more active.
Oh, my God.
Yikes, guys.
You guys also, for years, we forfeited the Latino vote to Republicans by not making a play for it. The Democratic Party was so slow to sign on to doing anything that wasn't just, like, fully half-assed. Just platform-wise, not even policy-wise, to help the Latino community, to represent the Latino community.
Right.
They did such a half-assed job of doing that for so many years that a voting bloc whose interests naturally align with our caucus's interests, whose interests as both, you know, like, a large number of blue-collar and low-wage workers, whose interests include, whose fields often include fields that were unionized or are unionized. Right. We're talking about an immigrant community here that could be better served by more humane immigration policy. I mean, this has been something that we could have absorbed into our sort of larger outreach plan as Democrats 30 years ago and not even be having this conversation. But the fact that now, when this is suddenly a really important voting block and a voting block that some Democrats on the left were working really hard to get on board, that they haven't even pretended to half care about what the Latino community's, you know, needs are, what their interests are, like what their organizing plans are, is mind-blowing.
I know, and I agree with you, because our interests do align with their interests on so many things.
So many things.
But I think to ignore them sort of leaves an opening, because there are a lot of things, at least certainly in terms of social issues, whether it be
abortion or gay marriage or whatever. That's how we lost this thread before.
Is they align just as much on a lot of those issues with Republicans as they do Democrats. So to disengage with them is a dangerous game that you're playing, because you could look back on this 10 years from now as all Hispanics continue to vote for whatever Republican presidential candidate there is, and you've lost the thread.
It's wild, too, because so many critical Democratic states also have large Latino communities that also need to be engaged, so that state level politics is productive for Democrats. Ignoring the Latino community also is also problematic in California for us, because this is where a lot of our Democratic base comes from. It's problematic in Arizona, because Democrats would really like to flip Arizona. It's been trending purple for a long time. And Texas, too. Texas could be ours if we didn't have somebody who came of age at a time when the Democrats were, like, specifically not engaging Latino voters, which is what Joe Biden is. He's using a playbook from 20 years ago, when before we bothered caring about what Latino voters needed. And in the process, also insulting young voters constantly, which is too bad, because so many Latino voters are also young voters.
Right.
I mean, we're just sort of like hitting in an intersection that, like, in 1992, like, the Clinton campaign didn't bother with. And, like, we're just going with it now, even though demographics have shifted. And this is, like, a really critical voting block now.
Yeah. He doesn't get it.
He doesn't get it. And it's wild to think that someone would not get it.
It's
wild to, first of all, think that there are any voters that you wouldn't try to go after.
Well, right.
I mean, I think, you know, if we learned anything from Howard Dean, it's that you try everywhere with everyone.
Yep.
You do your best.
Yep.
And you don't assume that, you know, you can't win in places that you don't usually win. And you also don't assume that voters aren't gettable. But you don't forfeit huge blocks of voters to Republicans because you, like, can't be bothered to figure out who they are.
No. Ay, ay, ay.
And even, by the way, even if this means that there is no such thing as a Latino voting bloc because the bloc gets split, because that could certainly happen too. You know, certainly all white voters don't vote together.
Like, no,
you know,
of course.
And to some extent,
you still want to get as many as you can by making a play for them.
Like, figure out a way to make that a Democratic bloc.
Pretend like they exist.
Right. Yeah.
At
just
minimum.
Acknowledge that you've heard about them. Like, the other bad thing that could happen is that this could never materialize into a bloc and it becomes a wash. And then we still have idiot white people ruining everything for everyone.
Right.
It's like,
right.
Save us from those people.
Oh, man. I know. Speaking of idiot white people that we need to be saved from. Wisconsin. The Supreme Court specifically. Struck down the state's stay-at-home order. And so it just ended. So now it's done.
Yeah, it's over.
It's over.
And it also, even
little fanfare. It's just done.
The Republicans had asked them to hold off on a ruling until they could work out a deal with the governor, and the court just didn't listen to them and put a ruling out that went into effect immediately, and so they were just like, oh, it's over. Oh.
Right.
No one had a plan.
Right.
Local...
Tony Evers also didn't have his own plan,
seemed to be rolling a little more plan-free than he should be.
Yes, because he was plan-free. His only plan during their primary was to get people killed.
That's right.
Which he was successful at. I don't know if they've died, but they've definitely got coronavirus from that primary.
Someone's
and
died,
that was, I realized that Republicans tried as hard as they could to do him dirty, but, like, he was ill-prepared for that fight. And it seems like he has been ill-prepared for this fight also.
Sure has.
So, I don't know about that guy.
the entire middle of the country is falling apart.
It's not great.
There's a little bit of a Michigan situation.
It's a big Michigan situation, right?
The situation being that armed protesters are making it so that the legislature can't meet.
Right. And I think that they are, I think they're suing Gretchen Whitmer, too.
Yeah. This is like the actual definition of tyranny, I feel like.
Yes.
Like, tyranny is not the government asking you to wear a face mask. It's armed protesters making it so that the democratically elected representatives of the people of Michigan are not able to go do the people's business. That's right. Tyranny.
That's tyranny.
It's like ridiculous.
Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah. So that's. Anyway,
pull it together, great. Midwest.
Also, speaking of small government, Justin Amash decided not to run for president.
Oh my gosh.
That's.
Where did that come from?
That. It was
Is
on
he the first
doc.
Person in history to have an exploratory committee and then decide not to run?
I was going to say, I feel like this is. A historic moment for all of us.
It is.
And I also want to know what, maybe he found out that small government was not in right now because there's a huge crisis going on and people actually do need the government, it turns out.
Maybe that's what the exploratory committee led him to believe, that maybe maybe America wasn't, you know.
Ready for the end of government.
Clamoring for a libertarian right now.
As our government collapses, the last thing we need is someone who doesn't believe in government. For good or evil. I feel like the Republicans believe in government. They just believe in it for evil. Libertarians don't believe in it for any use.
Right.
That's, at least if you have the government, you can reroute it to good. But if you don't have it, you can't do anything.
Right.
You're just stuck. And without a government, you can have trillionaires. Because we're going to have those, too. Because Jeff Bezos is on track to become a trillionaire.
That's it.
In 2 years. Or in 6 years.
Right. Now, a lot of things would have to go right for him for that to happen. And wrong for us.
Let me tell you, though. The trends currently point to things only going right for him and wrong for us because
that's the thing. Yeah, because for him to become a trillionaire by 2026, he would have to continue growing his wealth at 34% a year, which would be a lot over the next 6 years. But like, the man has made $28 billion in 2020 while, you know, tens of millions of people have become unemployed and the entire economy has gone to shit.
That's
right. So the idea that he might be able to increase his wealth 34% a year for the next 6 years is not wild to me.
Also, his wealth has been growing at 34% a year while wages have been stagnant for like decades. So we are giving him our money.
Yeah, it seems as though he doesn't need the rest of the economy to be functioning properly for him to continue to make 34%, to grow his wealth 34%.
I think he does better the less functional it is.
It seems like he has. A lot of billionaires have.
I think a definition of a failed state might be that you might get your first trillionaire while the entire nation's economy crumbles.
Right. Just another representation of late stage dying capitalism.
One more reminder that we invented money. We gave him something of our own creation.
Yep.
So we can take it back. We made the whole thing up. The economy is not real. We invented all the rules and the rules can change because they're not serving us right now.
Yeah.
He is not a trillionaire because he is that much smarter or better than us. He's a trillionaire because we let him be one.
Right. And we continue to do so.
And we continue to do so. And it's money that we invented as a society. It's not, money is not real. We made up money. It's so that we don't have to barter chickens with our dentists and shit like that.
That's right.
So like, money is not a real thing. We can, in the same way that if he had 143 billion chickens,
That
would be too many chickens for one person to take care of. So we could be like, hey, dude, we can take some of those chickens off your hands. That way the chickens don't die and we can eat the chickens too, or whatever people do with chickens.
Yep.
Pet them, have feathers. I don't know what chickens are for. But instead, we're just like, keep the chickens and it's cool if they die. We'd rather starve than take your chickens.
Right.
Even though chickens are not inherently anyone's resource because they're just they're animals like us. Like, in any case.
The chickens example.
Speaking of billionaires.
Remains my favorite. It's the best one.
It's the best one so far.
Yeah.
Bloomberg. Oh, no. Shit. I already violated our rule of last week. I'm not going to violate it again. A certain billionaire former mayor is talking about where to spend a tiny portion of his massive fortune in an effort to reelect Joe Biden.
Joe Biden. Right.
That's right. There are a few PACs that this certain billionaire former mayor could consider.
Right. Unite the Country, Priorities USA, American Bridge. Nobody knows who they are. They're all horrible. Let's be honest with ourselves.
That's right. no one knows how much he'll spend, but people are anticipating he could spend as much as $250 million. The man has $60 billion. This is a man who could spend $1 billion on Joe Biden's reelection and not have any measurable difference to his life. Not have noticed that he did it.
You could hide that in a, like, that would, if that left his bank account, he would not notice it the
next morning.
There
would be no way to find out. Right. I mean, even think to yourself, if you have $61, does it make a measurable difference to you to have 60 or 61? Not really. Like, even at that level, you can see that it's like, listen, is $61 better than $60? Sure. But if you had, if you had $60 or $61 and you also had billions and billions of dollars on top of that, so it was a sum that meant nothing to you and could not in any way measurably change your life, that $1 is not the, you're not making a choice between you and a candy bar with that $1. That $1 doesn't buy you anything because you already had a dollar to buy a candy bar with.
Right.
Then it's a meaningless sum of bullshit money. Another person whose money we have let them keep.
Yep.
If he had 60 billion chickens. No man can use 60 billion chickens.
That's right.
You only need a few. You can't eat the eggs of 60 billion chickens. You need maximum 2 to 3 chickens if you want to have all the eggs you could ever eat.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. By the way, this unnamed mayor that we speak of was on a Zoom call with Biden this week. It was on some digital, you know, virtual thing with like 350 local leaders, including
all of whom he paid off with his stupid mayor's fund.
Right, exactly. Including, mayors, whatever. And they were all talking about what efforts cities could do to combat coronavirus.
As if Joe Biden has been anywhere near a plan for coronavirus yet.
Having some of those $60 billion funneling through the tax system would be a starting point.
Be a huge starting, I feel like he has a net worth that is bigger than some countries' GDPs.
Yes. There was that thing, I don't know if you saw, AOC tweeted this week a story about Bill Gates talking about like how he was like trying to figure out what the best way would be for like all of his billionaire buddies to like actually sort of like help the most, you know, during the coronavirus. And she was like, if only there was a fund that billionaires could, you know, give a portion of their income or wealth to, and we would, you know, we could even have a federal agency that could oversee it and figure out where it was going to go and everything. Of course, a bunch of men jumped in and was like, that sounds like a payroll tax, or, you know, a payroll tax. And she was like, yeah, that's right.
On purpose.
She got mansplained on Twitter about like the joke that she herself was trying to make.
Oh, man, you guys. Anyway.
But that's the thing that both of these two could be doing. If they're looking for ways
helpful.
To help.
That's right. If you're looking to help out, and there are so many ways to help with giving your money to people that need it in an efficient manner where we can identify where the needs are and then give it towards those needs instead of the ones that are visible to you that might not be the real needs.
That's right. Yes.
Especially if one of you is a known racist and therefore is going to find certain needs, especially invisible, including needs of a specific community that will also remain unnamed, but is in dire need of some assistance at this moment.
Okay, let's move on because I don't know who we're naming and not naming at this point. We are naming Richard Burr.
That's right.
And the FBI is also naming Richard Burr.
That's right.
And they're naming him by way of a search warrant.
That's right. And they seized his cell phone, too.
They sure did. Yeah. Richard Burr, stepping down as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee for
finding out he had a little too much intelligence about some things he wasn't supposed
Richard
to know about.
Smartest man in the U.S. Senate, Richard Burr.
Can predict the stock market.
Right. It's like a magician, that guy.
this is the first shakeup of this sort since good old Bob Menendez had to step down as the head of the Foreign Relations Committee when he got indicted.
God, there's so many awful people out there,
I know.
Right, though, aren't there? Because Kelly Loeffler from Georgia
recused herself from her own committee.
Right. She hasn't, they haven't issued a warrant for her yet, so I guess like we should give her a fucking medal or something. I don't know. Ditto Dianne Feinstein. She's cooperating.
She,
with the FBI. I mean, so, like, again, Kudos
hasn't
to
had
her.
To give up any committee
Medal
assignments
of
as of yet.
For Dianne Feinstein.
Right.
Jesus.
Yeah,
I
so the
hate
Senate
everyone.
Is a cesspool of crime at the moment. Everyone thought it was totally normal that we do a televised graduation address for all of the nation's seniors and not invite the current president, but instead just invite Obama and hope that no one thought. And interestingly, no one thought that was weird.
Right. No one invited Joe Biden either. And
no one invited
you,
Joe Biden.
You noted to me that maybe it's because there's an active campaign going on. Well, an active air quotes campaign.
Right.
I think that they also probably just didn't care to have him.
Also, he's not a guy you want speaking off the cuff to a bunch of teenagers.
Or that's, on the cuff.
It's on any of the ways that people speak.
No.
That's I.
No.
I Obama's speech was very comforting, and he sort of used it to poke gently at the Trump administration's terrible response to the pandemic.
Yeah.
But indirectly, as has been his way, people got very exercised on Twitter because there were two commencement addresses. One was for HBCU graduates,
yeah.
And then one was for high school graduates. And at the HBCU one, he was a little bit more pointed. And he said, more than anything, this pandemic has fully, finally torn back the curtain on the idea that so many of the folks in charge know what they're doing. A lot of them aren't even pretending to be in charge. And he's not wrong.
He's not wrong.
He also said during the high school one, doing what feels good, what's convenient, what's easy, that's how little kids think. Unfortunately, a lot of so-called grown-ups, including some with fancy titles and important jobs, still think that way. Which is why things are so screwed up. I hope that instead you decide to ground yourself in the values that last, like honesty, hard work, responsibility, fairness, generosity, respect for others. So, in any case, it was sort of a... He was trying to give a presidential address without being the president and having a reason to give an address.
Yeah.
I guess he sort of did that. I mean, to some extent, it was nice to hear an actual professional statesman give an address that wasn't lunacy.
Yeah.
And then be like, oh, right. Remember when people gave speeches and you didn't worry the whole time?
Yeah. I think this is also the beginning of what we're going to be seeing more of from him, because he is going to try his best to pull Joe Biden across the finish line here. And if anybody can do it, it's him, honestly, because I think that there are a lot of people, especially right now, who are pining for leaders who do know what they're doing or are acting like they're knowing what they're doing. And sure, does Obama probably get like the core of Trump's base riled up in a way that I don't particularly care for? Yes.
Right.
But I do think that those people who are sort of like, okay, we can have something different, you know?
Right.
Like, I think that, like, Obama sort of allows for that type of thinking more so than even Biden himself does, just because Biden is a big, giant nothing that nobody cares about.
I hope that in sort of doing that the Democrats don't forget that one other way to pull themselves over the finish line is with ideas. Because Obama is sort of uniquely gifted. We can't all be Obama, and we shouldn't all have to be Obama.
No.
And also, Obama wasn't particularly effective as a legislator. So
correct.
There are reasons that you maybe don't even want that guy to be the guy.
That's right.
You want that guy to be on your team because he's a great salesman.
Yep.
And he's also somebody that I think everyone trusts, has sort of like a basically intact moral compass and is like a responsible person.
Right.
Which is why I think we all pine for the days of Obama, even though those days were like kind of shitty. Because it felt nice to just have like a reasonable person in public life.
Yep.
I hope that he is able to both use those skills to all of our advantages.
Right.
And then also that doesn't become a replacement for having other more important skills, such as the skill of legislating and governing.
Right. I just think that it's, you know, we saw, I think Trump called Obama like grossly incompetent today. Which is rich coming from him. But I also think that, like, for the reasons that I said, I get why he's doing it. He's trying to fire up his base. But, like, he also needs to remember that Obama is a person who won 2 presidential elections and won in a fairly sizable landslide.
Yeah.
So I think
with
that,
a lot
like,
of his voters.
With a lot of his voters. So I think that it's a... I don't know that that is a game that, like, Trump really wants to play. It seems like he might want to play it, but I think it's silly of him to play it.
I totally agree. I think there is a small vocal minority of his base that gets really fired up from it.
Right. And that's the racist part of it.
That's the racist part of the base.
Right.
But that actually Obama is one of the most respected sort of he's not an elder statesman because he's young still. But right, like, exactly. Sort of respected elder statesman in the sense that he's an ex-statesman
right.
In the country. And I don't think people actually want to hear him destroyed by someone like Donald Trump.
They don't.
It's because he's like a man with class.
Yeah.
Unlike Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Who is not. But good news, guys. We are on our way to having a super duper missile. And we finally have the Space Force. So everything is working out. The Space Force, which is the newest branch of the armed services, now has its own flag. The flag looks like it's a prop from Star Wars. We established it in December, if you recall. It's the first new military branch since 1947.
Yep.
And no one's really sure what they do or what it's about. It's 16,000 airmen and civilians. They're technically part of the Air Force, though, and so it's not clear what the Space Force is, what's distinct about the Space Force, other than that it has a fun flag now.
Yeah.
But the best news is that at the Friday ceremony where they unveiled the Star Wars prop, Trump said that we're building a super-duper missile. They can travel 17 times faster than what we have right now. So we're
That's what he called it. God, I hope that's the official name.
Super-duper missile.
It has to be, right?
It has to be. I mean, it's certainly going to be the unofficial name forever.
Well, true. Yeah.
And I hope that in the future we'll be able to say things like, can we defund the super-duper missile program?
Oh, man.
That would
man.
Make me happy. Yeah. So that's the news this week.
That's it.
Next week, we'll be back with some rage. We'll be back
with
some
thoughts. Oh, my God. If I go to a darker place this week, you're going to have to send help. I don't know. I have to be institutionalized.
I was in that dark place a few weeks ago, and then
yeah.
I decided that I decided that I could be optimistic in the long term without being optimistic in the short term.
That's what I'm going to have to do for myself.
Yeah.
Actually.
I still think people are inherently good and that we should take care of them. I think that government can work.
Yes.
I have not changed my core values. I just don't think that any of these fools share any of my core values. Right. That's disappointing.
It is.
But I think a lot of us do share these core values, actually.
I don't.
I think it's about figuring out how to coordinate ourselves.
Right.
I think one of our disadvantages as a country always has been that we're kind of a chaotic people.
Sure.
You know, we're not easily, and that protects us, I think, from some layer of authoritarianism as well.
Sure.
Because I think having a leader like Trump can also turn you into Nazi Germany pretty fast. So, you know, I think that the U.S. has both good and bad instincts competing amongst everyone. But that part of what protects us from the kinds of extremism that you see in organized countries is the fact that you can't keep track of what's going on here. It's too big. We're too diverse. It's too many people with too many opinions. We have too many layers of government. And I think that that is sort of protecting us on some level from like from society collapsing as we know it quickly. It's collapsing slowly right now, but not as fast as it could. But with that said, that makes it very hard for those of us who share these core values to find each other and coordinate in meaningful ways. And that is why we're frustrated.
It is indeed.
Yeah. In any case, if you need me to give a speech at your church in the coming weeks about optimism, I'm available for hire for optimism speeches.
Yeah, you should go on the speaking circuit.
Yeah, I'll go on the speaking circuit. It'll be a Zoom speaking circuit because no one's can leave their house. But but if you, listener, have an organization that you need a pep talk delivered to, I am taking requests because I am literally just in my home board. So, you know, let me know.
Your speaking fees are high.
My speaking fees are high because I also need to make a living. But I promise you a great speech. In any case, we'll talk to you next week.
Bye, guys.
Bye.